Welcome to Sculpture Vulture. I'm Lucy Branch, a sculptural conservator and author, bringing you a series of interviews with some amazing sculptors who inspire me and I hope will do the same for you. You can see the photographs accompanying the interview, the episode show notes, and get a free novel from sculpturevulture.co.uk. Happy New Year, Sculpture Vultures, and thank you for joining me today. I do hope you've all managed to have some kind of break over the holiday period. It's the only time of year that we stop as a company, and so we actually properly recharge and rest. Unfortunately, my little girl managed to get COVID again. 8 weeks it's been since the last time she had COVID, so she's COVID-tastic at the moment, poor little thing. But thankfully, she's all recovered now. About the most productive thing I got done over the Christmas period was to watch some really excellent TV, catch up on it. I think I particularly, as somebody who is mad about fantasy fiction, I really enjoyed The Witcher on Netflix. So that would be my top tip if anyone hasn't come across that yet. I really do feel like my year is on pause at the moment because for my sins, I am starting jury duty. And so probably I'm not going to get an awful lot done that I usually do in January. I try and get all my manager tasks out the way, try and set the year up so that it will run really smoothly. Not that life ever runs particularly smoothly, but you know, the effort is made. But I really am, I'm praying I don't get a long case. I do have an idea, fortunately, for a book that is sort of percolating through the back of my mind. And so I'm hoping that I will at least get some moments to sort of mull it over while we're sitting about and waiting, which I'm sure there'll be a lot of. But one of the bonuses, I think, probably, of being a creative person is that you've always got that kind of idea or little nugget that you need to explore and see whether it might turn into anything. Most of the time they don't, sometimes they do flower. But it's usually that thinking phase that decides whether or not a project is going to be worth pursuing. And in life, if I don't get enough time to sort of sit and think, then quite often things don't happen. So idle moments are never a waste of time. So my guest today has been a long time coming. I chased him throughout season one, but he was so fleet of foot, just as the animals that he portrays are. And I am very glad that I eventually caught up with him. He's been incredibly patient because it really has been quite a lot of months since we recorded this. But my guest today is Charlie Langdon. He is one of the most sought after equine artists of our time. And just to be even more specific, his interest is in thoroughbred racehorses. His sculptures revel in the difference in attitude, character and physicality that sets champion racehorses apart. And he's undertaken major commissions of incredibly famous racehorses, including the tribute to the four-time Gold Cup winner Yates in the Parade Ring at Ascot Racecourse. His interview is particularly interesting, and that's because his area of work is so incredibly niche that anyone who thinks that they can't possibly build a business by focusing in on just one thing is going to be proved wrong by his story. I began our conversation today by asking, have you always been creative?
Yeah, as far as I can remember, I've always loved drawing, painting, sculpting, making things. You know, I've always been one of those types of people. I could never, well, reading, I never really liked sort of sitting down with a book and reading. I much prefer sort of getting on and making stuff and getting my hands dirty, really.
Practical.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, even if I got stuff wrong a lot, it was still enjoyable to me sort of mucking around with stuff, yeah.
So was that because there was someone at home that was very practical or inspiring with that kind of thing?
I don't know what it was, actually. I think at home, so my brother's I've got two brothers. My older brother's two years older than me, and we always used to compete fiercely at everything we did, whether it was, I mean, we both played a lot of sports, so we were always sort of egging each other on at that. And then it was the same if it was drawing or painting or whatever. We used to do these drawing competitions at home, and I was always furious I couldn't get you know, as good as he was. So I think it started off with kind of that sort of thing. And then my dad had a kind of, well, I think most dads have like a garden shed type situation. I remember going in there on Saturday mornings with him, and he'd have his kind of workbench, and I had a kind of small workbench, and we used to kind of make stuff on a Saturday morning. It was never anything any good, but it was just nice mucking around with tools. And then I think I was very lucky with the teachers I had at school, actually. They were all really encouraging, and I won an art competition when I was 7, and the prize for which was a pencil. Yeah, I know, an HB pencil.
Hugely inspiring.
Yeah, well, I mean, winning anything.
Yeah, sort of age, that's true.
6 or 7 is pretty good news. But yeah, I think it was just kind of these early, you know, those early things which stick in my mind anyway, and then those kind of lead on to doing other things.
See, we've got a workshop at home, and I've got 2 boys and a girl, but particularly the 2 boys, I kind of keep thinking maybe the tools and things will inspire them and get them going. But all that they do is they come through the hall and they fall over something and they go, I wish we lived in a normal house. Why is there a compressor in the doorway? Or, you know, why is there a mould here? And so it hasn't really translated into them actually. Apart from if they want money, I get them to manage to clean some brushes or clean out my whatever. Yeah, if they're after money, then they might actually venture into the studio, but that's about it. So
they'll find it pretty cool one day, I'm sure.
Not sure. Anyway, so when did the passion for horses begin? Because it does seem like a huge passion.
Yeah, it started very early. I was very lucky. I had a pony called Wiz, who was... but as bonkers as the name sounds, he was a little grey Welsh mountain pony. I started riding when I was 6 and just really loved it. And used to go and just muck around with him in the paddock and stuff. And I never rode seriously or anything, but I really enjoyed that connection. And, you know, I never really wanted to do anything like hunting, or I wasn't really into racing, to be honest. And I just... you know, I just had a connection with this little horse. And then I started doing drawings for friends. My mum was really passionate about racing and she loved her horses. And my great uncle did as well. So there was a kind of racing connection with the family, and horses were always around in my peripheral vision growing up. And I started off in my sort of school holidays doing drawings of their horses and friends' horses. And there was something about the structure of the horse head in particular, which I found really satisfying to draw. I think it's because, I mean, I always used to start off by drawing the eye first and then working out from there. And I think with the horse, because you've got the sort of facial crest that comes down like the top of the jawbone there, that was quite a good reference point to go for. And then you can build out from there. And I just found the structure of the horse head really satisfying to draw. And I think as I started to draw more horses, I got more into it, and then the anatomy of the whole horse became really appealing to me, and they're just a fascinating animal to look at and to try and paint and to draw. And then it actually became even more interesting when I started sculpting, trying to put them together anatomically and figure it all out. And then I just became increasingly fascinated by horses and racing and looking at what makes a really top racehorse and the differences between each champion racehorse. So that the whole thing's kind of, you know, grown really. It hasn't really come from an initial love of racing. Mm-hmm. Especially it's just kind of grown quite organically, I suppose.
One of the reasons I wanted to interview you so badly was because I'm a huge horse fan, but I worked in racing for quite a long time. And it is a very special world, got a very particular culture. What was it that appealed to you about it?
As I started to get commissions and they started to get bigger, and I got to go and see these amazing horses and these incredible farms, you know, particularly thinking about Highclere and Coolmore Stud in Ireland, just seeing what goes into these amazing animals.
Oh, it's incredible.
And you know, the effort that these guys take to look after their horses and the breeding side of it. It's just always so fascinating going and looking at foals when they're born and what makes a good foal, then what, you know, going to the sales and looking at yearlings and then seeing them start to race as a two-year-old, and what all these guys, the real horsemen that look at a horse and can tell in a couple of minutes whether they're going to be in the frame as a champion horse or not. You know, that's what I've been trying to get to grips with, because I find that I have to almost get up to their level pretty quick. When I go and see a horse, I don't have, and I try and have as long with it as I can, and I normally spend a week or 10 days with each horse. But I've got to be able to look at a horse and see what they see, and see little things that are off, because those are all the things that I've got to put in, all the little characteristics and things that make horses as different as, you know, people look. Horses look completely different as well. So you've got to be able to lock into those differences really quickly. And I found it fascinating learning off the top horsemen, you know, Harry King, who runs the stud at Coolmore, and John Carolyn Warren and people like them. You know, they're just around horses all the time, and you just pick up so much. And they come and have a look at my sculptures. And I mean, Harry King from Coolmore, he used to, if I was doing a life-size sculpture, he'd fly over from Ireland, and I'd pick him up from the airport at Heathrow, and he'd come to the studio for probably all of 40 minutes, an hour, just to have a look and talk it through with me and see if there were things that were off or anything I could change. And then we'd discuss why, and then he'd fly back to Ireland 40 minutes later. You know, the effort that goes into these things, it's fascinating.
And so did you go and train formally or not at art school or anything?
Yeah, I did. So I went to a very good school, Radley College, just outside of Abingdon, that had a fantastic art department, and I was so lucky to go there. They had, you know, everything you could possibly want to do. They had a ceramics department, they had a sculpture department, they had painting, drawing, photography, printmaking. You know, it was a great place to get started. And then after I left Radley, I got a very small art scholarship, a travel art scholarship. So I decided to go to Florence, and I'd been there on a history of art trip with the school about a year before, and we'd gone to a very small art school called Charles Cecil, and we had an hour life drawing class there, and I learned more in that hour than I'd ever learned at any art class before. So I was like, well, as soon as I can, I'm going to go back. So in the summer after I left school, I went there for a month and learned an enormous amount. And then by that time, I already had a place at Edinburgh Art College. So I went there for a year. Actually, I was intending to go there for a full 4 years and do the foundation course and then specialize in... I wasn't quite sure at that point. I was hoping to do kind of fine art, and then I was actually thinking about going into film for a bit, because I didn't know whether, you know, I don't know whether a career in fine art was going to
be a thing. Yeah.
Be a thing at that point. So I started doing the foundation course at Edinburgh, and I didn't really enjoy it, to be honest. I didn't feel like I was learning anything at all. There was all the learning that I'd had in Italy that summer before just wasn't there. There was no academic learning, no structure.
You'd been completely spoilt by Florence, it sounds like, though.
Yeah, I'd be completely, completely spoilt. You know, it was an amazing experience. And then to come back and not, because that's what I wanted from art school. I wanted it to be my, you know, it's like learning your scales, playing a musical instrument. That's what I really wanted. And then I felt like I could go off and do my own thing after that, in whatever medium it was going to be. But I wanted some direction. I was really kind of hungry for that at that stage, and I didn't feel like I was getting it. So I left after a year and went back to Florence and did a year and a half there. And it was very structured portrait painting. Well, initially it was life drawing from the model in the mornings, and then it was drawing from the cast in the afternoon, all in charcoal. And you'd spend months doing the same drawing, you know, really observing things properly. And then, I mean, I was working in charcoal for pretty much the whole of the first year, and I did, towards the end, I did sculpture in the afternoons, and then went on to oil painting and portraits in the second year. And I was there for a year and a half in total, and I felt that after a year and a half, I might have stayed a little bit longer, but I wanted to get back and get on, and I felt like I'd got a really good grounding in what it takes to get a painting started, get a drawing started, get a sculpture started, and the basics in observational technique. And then I wanted to just sort of take it from there and put my own thing into it and learn on my own a bit. So
you were ready.
Well, I probably really wasn't. I really wasn't, you know, ready at all. But I just felt like I wanted to jump in with it and try and get myself out there. I left when I was 21, I think it was, and I came back and did an exhibition almost straight away. And I just wanted to get, I felt like if I was going to get my career going, I needed to just get on with it and, yeah, you know, get my name out there and get started.
How did you pay the bills at first? I mean, was it couldn't have been a paying gig from day one?
No, it wasn't. I mean, the first job I got back, luckily, there was a guy who was a friend of my father's who, he became High Sheriff of Wiltshire. And
is that a real thing? High Sheriff?
Yeah, it's a real thing. And he wears like this amazing like black velvet kind of
that
garb.
That is such a cool title.
And he has a sword and everything. It's really cool. Anyway, he was this amazing guy. He supported loads of people locally and did lots of charity work. And he was a fantastic supporter of everything, really. And I think he sort of picked up on the fact that this guy had just come back from art school and needed to sink his teeth into something. So he commissioned me to do a full-length portrait of him in his High Sheriff kit.
Wow.
And we had a great time. He came and did sittings and fell asleep mostly, but we ended up...
Sorry, was that a sculpture or was it a...
No, it was a painting.
A painting, yeah. Okay.
It was great. And then he was very generous with his time after that, so he used his contacts to promote it. So he got an article done for me in Wiltshire Life and started to kind of push me, and then he sort of unveiled it at the local pub and got people to come and got people talking. You know, he was just a brilliant person to have, you know, pushing me from when I first got back. And then little commissions started coming in, and I was just working regularly, and the money wasn't great, but I was lucky enough I could set up a studio at home in an old stable block. So I didn't have the expense of that or being in London. I was down in Wiltshire, and I could just kind of take my time and get on with these small commissions. And I then started doing sculpture on the side, and to get that promoted, I got a loan from the bank, and I did a sculpture for a charity auction, and it ended up raising quite a lot of money. And then that sort of got my name out there as a sculptor, and then the sculpture side started to take off. And
I'm kind of totally amazed that the bank would, I mean, every time, I don't know, anything to do with the bank, they're always like, oh, if it's art related, then it's risky. And, you know, I'm quite amazed that you got a good one.
I had to get my dad to guarantee it. But yeah, it was, well, it was before, so that was back in, I think it was before like the financial crash, like in 2008.
Right.
So it was kind of just on that sort of, on that cusp of things being a bit more difficult.
Yeah.
But I remember it being a massive punt. It was a silver sculpture, and I got this loan, and my dad was like, what are you doing? This is not going to work.
Thanks, Dad.
I think the charity were a bit a bit worried about it as well, but it went well, thank God. And things have sort of got moved on from there, sculpture wise.
Because I mean, your work, it's quite a narrow niche you work in. Is that by choice, or has that kind of been forced upon you because you've had success with the horses?
Initially, I really didn't want to specialise in any one particular thing. Leonardo da Vinci has always been my biggest kind of inspiration, really, about things. And I loved the way that he did everything. You know, he painted, he drew, he sculpted, he did, you know, everything. And I always thought, well, it's, you know, I'd love to be able to do that as well. I'd love to be able to paint, you know, paint, draw and sculpt as well in each medium, and not necessarily concentrate on doing horses in particular, maybe do portraits as well. And then I quickly realized that was just like, I couldn't do that. I'm nowhere near like talented enough to be able to keep doing it. And also I wasn't getting good enough at any one particular thing either. I didn't have, the commissions weren't allowing me enough time, well, the money and the commissions weren't allowing me enough time to develop in one, well, in all these areas at once. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go with the horses, and I'm really glad I did specialize in that, because I love doing it. And I think the portrait side of stuff, which I started off doing, the commissions thing, I wasn't really enjoying it, to be honest. I found it, whilst it was really interesting meeting lots of different people, I found the pressure of having a sitter in front of me very different to having a model, a paid model in front of me, and I wasn't really enjoying it that much. And the horse commissions kind of allowed me to do my own thing a bit more. And
it seems to have been lucky for you. Like, thing is that sometimes things just, they come a little bit easier in one direction than another, I think, you know, you find. And there's no rhyme or reason to it.
No.
But
No, exactly right. I've been so lucky. I can trace like the work that I'm doing now back to, I mean, five or six people really that have made a difference in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it is just a huge amount of luck. You know, one person, and it's all down to other people. That's the thing. It's people like pushing you or backing you, or, you know, buying a piece and showing it to somebody who then does something else. Literally, it's all down to other people, you know, taking a punt and supporting an artist trying to get going. And it's, you know, it's really nice that people do take a chance on young artists sometimes.
So, I mean, have you got a routine in the studio? Do you have anything that gets you going, the creative juices flowing when you're working, or is it much more standardized, you know, like going and working in the bank?
Well, I used to be a bit more formulaic with it, I think, just trying to do similar hours to a normal working day. But actually, I find that I'm more creative in the evening. I tend to like working when there aren't other people around, you know, when people are, I don't know, at home, or, you know, the whole area is quiet. I find I get sort of more creative in the evening. Like listening to classical music. It can be anything really, but I used to do that a lot, and I've actually come back to that recently, and it's actually really helping creatively. What else? I listen to a lot of audiobooks. A lot of audiobooks.
Thank God for Audible.
I know. God. But yeah, I mean, I sometimes find it quite difficult to get started, but within like just the physical act of starting to put wax on or clay on or something, as soon as I do that, I'm away. I can go for hours. But sometimes it's just getting
making stuff do it. I love 4 a.m. That is my time. I know that's ridiculous, but you know what that comes from? That comes from racing, because we used to feed at 25 past four in the morning. So you'd have to get up at four. You'd sit by the Arga because it was the only warm place and sit and have a black coffee. And then by 20 past four, we were out. And that 4 a.m. thing for me is this silent time where no one else in the house is awake. You know, even the dog doesn't want to talk to me. And so I get completely left left alone. And there's I just love that energy about that time of day. But then the later that you go in the day, by about 7 o'clock in the evening, I'm dead. You can't even speak to me. But it's a funny thing that you find your like little time and little rhythm, and it just helps a bit.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I think it's that thing you were just saying though about that quiet time when nobody else is around. I often find like working on a Saturday as well is really nice or a Sunday, because like nobody else is really working. It just feels kind of like a quiet time.
Mm. So how do you tend to get your work? Are you completely commission driven, or do you make things and actually sell them, find the buyer after you've made them, or how does it work?
Well, it's a bit of both really, but mainly commission stuff, to be honest, just because that's the way it's gone really. And my work is really based on capturing the portrait of each horse that I do, so therefore by default it kind of is a commission based way of working really. But I have been finding recently that it's because the horses are normally speaking in conformation pose, and you know, it hasn't really helped me creatively enormously to be doing that too regularly. So I do try and do my own work in between and have things that are for sale through galleries or my website, but I haven't done a huge amount of it, but I'm starting to do it more now.
Mm-hmm. And if you were, you know, trying to give other people thinking about becoming a professional maybe an insight, I mean, do you have to do an awful lot of marketing? Do you have to, is it all word of mouth, social media? How do you manage to tell people about yourself?
I've always been really bad at that part of things. When I did my first exhibition, I decided that I was going to get a company to do it. So I got a PR company to do it, who were brilliant. They were racing, because the exhibition was racing focused. So I got a racing PR company to do the promotion for it, John O. Spence Consulting, who were absolutely brilliant. It was so good. It was kind of a new thing for them, getting into the art side of stuff, but they had, you know, all the racing connections, and they really helped get the exhibition into the right audience, which was brilliant. And although it was a kind of, I just used them for, I think it was maybe the first year or 6 months or so regularly, and then I'd use them sort of now and again for the odd sort of specific thing. But they really helped. It was expensive way of doing things, but it got my work in front of the right people at the right time, and it was a really important thing to do. I think. I mean, most of the stuff now, the racing world is really quite small, as you probably know, and word of mouth now is definitely the most powerful thing. But that's just in my little niche. It's so small, the world that I work in. But as an artist, sort of wider than that, it's so hard. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to suggest what to do, really.
Well, no, you can only talk about your own journey. You can't worry about other people's, but everyone sort of comes at it differently. But, I mean, have there been days where you've thought, I want to give it up?
Not yet. No. No,
that's great.
No, they really haven't. I'm so lucky. I absolutely love what I do, and I feel really lucky to be doing it. And you know, these commissions don't come up very often, and portraits of horses, you know, they really don't come up very often, and it's really competitive to get these jobs, and the people that commission and put a lot of faith in you to get it right, you know, they're big jobs, and these things last forever, and they're a portrait of a successful racehorse, and it's also a piece of racing history, and you've got to capture that right, I feel, and it's a huge privilege to do it. So I absolutely love it, and I wouldn't do anything else, so yeah. It's lucky that I do love it.
Well, no, my favorite, one of my, I'm not supposed to choose favorite sculptures that I've worked on in my life, but because obviously, I mean, every sculpture I've worked on has something about it that makes it fantastic and unique. But Red Rum for me at Aintree, I just being like working on my hero was sort of a huge, I don't know, I can't really say to the client I'd do it for nothing, but I kind of would because of its being Red Rum. So is there a place you'd like to see one of your sculptures if you could, you know, make that choice? Have you kind of got a, like a little spot in mind? Maybe plant a seed if anyone's listening who's got who's got access to that race course. Or
Goodwood is a beautiful race course. It'd be amazing to have something there, but I mean, as beautiful as it is, I don't know where you'd put a sculpture really there, but it's a beautiful place. Newbury's my sort of local race course, so it'd be really nice to have something there.
Yeah.
Other than a race course, I'd love to have something in London somewhere, I think.
Yeah.
I've always really admired the equestrian sculptures that are in London.
Yeah.
I mean, I think some of them are so underrated. They're just really incredible sculptures in London. And
I spend my life banging that drum saying you don't need to go inside galleries, we've got this incredible gallery on your streets. You know, it's my poor kids, it's no wonder they probably hate sculpture because I spend my life dragging them out to look at things. But there's so many incredible things to see, and as you say, the equestrian sculpture, I mean, second to none.
It's absolutely amazing. And There was a sculptor called Adrian Jones who he was a vet. He was a soldier and then a vet, and he's done some of the best equestrian sculptures you can think of, really. And you wouldn't really notice, you know, a lot of people wouldn't probably really notice they were there, and they just drive past them and think of them as an adornment to a piece of architecture or something. But he was absolutely amazing. In my opinion, probably one of the best horse sculptors has ever been. And I hope he gets the recognition that he deserves, but I get a feeling maybe he doesn't.
Well, Charlie, tell people where they can find out more about you.
Well, I've got a website, which is charlielangton.com. And I've got an Instagram thing, which is @langtonsculptor.
Right. And is that your preferred social media? You like Instagram?
Yeah, I'm pretty rubbish at social media.
So people are not going to get a reply.
They might.
They're very lucky.
Very, very sporadically, not very often. Okay. And yeah, but I do put the odd thing on there.
Brilliant. Well, Charlie, thanks ever so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Charlie suggests that some of his success can be put down to circumstance. Having a brother to compete with, or maybe a mother and an uncle that worship at the altar of racing. But you can tell that Charlie's someone who listens to his instincts. He studied hard, but he knew when enough was enough, and he connected with someone who turned out to be a patron of sorts. And that just shows you that patrons aren't just a thing of the Renaissance. His patron helped him to get some traction. And you might be thinking, well, that's not exactly easily orchestrated. I don't know anyone with a big flock of connections like that. But I've always found that people want to help you succeed, even if all they have in their power is in very small ways. And providing you approach your relationships without expectation of gaining something, people will often do what they can to help you by word of mouth. And word of mouth is such an intangible but magical thing. Word of mouth is actually something I find really comforting, that the world is whispering, and some of those whispers are working on my behalf and carrying my career along and forwards without me having to hustle and push. But Charlie didn't only rely on the efforts of others. Again, his instincts were to lean into the reputation he'd already gained by using a PR company to tell the racing world more about him. Now, the success of this type of advertising is It's difficult to measure. It often isn't possible to say statistically, well, that item of press led to this commission. But it can have a very long tail. And if you're not the kind of character, which I think many creatives in business aren't, who feel that shouting about yourself is doable, it just might be too painful to do something like that. It can be much less painful to let somebody else approach that for you. And generally speaking, a PR approach to marketing is often less hard sell. They tend to go with slightly more interest-driven stories about you, which is more of a soft sell, but something at the same time which does gain people's attention. I encourage you to take a look at the blog post on sculpturevulture.co.uk, where I've put up some of the fabulous photos that Charlie sent me, and also you'll find the transcription of the interview if you'd like to read over it a little bit more slowly. Please support the podcast by buying a copy of my book, Bronze Behaving Badly. If you'd like to find out more about the best ways to care for bronze sculpture and the kinds of things that can do it a lot of harm. The book's written particularly for custodians of sculpture and collections and gives lots of useful advice but doesn't assume that you have any knowledge about bronze whatsoever. It's available in ebook and paperback from wherever books are sold online, and you can order it into your independent bookshops. It's also out in hardback, but frustratingly, there's a supply chain issue at the moment, and annoyingly, it is not available in the UK. I had to order a copy from Germany recently for a client. But anyway, it came really quickly, so it doesn't seem to matter where it's being printed. But please support the show by picking up a copy. Tune in next episode for my interview with Christina Charlesworth, who specialises in figurative sculpture and portraiture. In 2021 alone, she's completed public commissions for the Greta Thunberg Monument at Winchester University, Dame Ethel Smythe, the English composer and member of the women's suffrage movement, and Emily Wilding Davison, the activist and suffragette. Her journey is fascinating and her work exciting. You won't want to miss it. If you're looking for a new book, please consider one of my novels about the dark side of the art world, where sculpture is always at the heart of the story. You can get them on the show website, on the usual online retailers, or even better, keep your local library alive, ask for them in there. Thank you for joining me today. Sculpture Vulture has been brought to you by Antique Bronze.